For years, people used to migrate north into the United States through the cities. Then, in the early 1990s, trade policies began to affect patterns of immigration. The U.S. began building walls and sealing urban areas, pushing immigration routes to isolated and more desolate areas, like the desert. This is Kat Rodriguez.
That free trade was going to funnel migration, shift it to the north, was not something that was a shock to people, and it was definitely not a shock to the government. If people remember when NAFTA was being pushed in the early 90s and put out there as the answer to migration is going to solve the immigration problems, we would challenge that and say, well, if NAFTA, which passed in 1994, was supposed to solve the immigration problem, why is it that the walls began to be built in 1994? And we know that the reason for that is that they knew exactly what was going to happen. They knew where they were going to be displacing mostly poor agricultural workers who could not compete with genetically modified products being flooded into their markets. And they would head to cities looking for jobs, and they would eventually head north looking for better life. Their strategy that the U.S. government has had as far as controlling the border has been to seal urban areas or traditional points of crossing, thereby shifting traffic into the more isolated, desolate areas with three objectives. Number one, it would be more difficult for people to cross. Number two, it would be easier for us to catch them. And number three, some of them would die, which would deter other people from crossing. So our government actually factored death into the equation, into their solution, quote unquote, for controlling the border. It definitely is harder for people to cross. It is arguable whether it's easier to catch them, and people have absolutely been dying, and they've been dying at this point, in estimates are in over 5,000 men, women, and children, but that has not deterred migration at all.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll continue to talk with Kat Rodriguez, coordinator for Derechos Humanos. We'll also talk with Mike Wilson, a humanitarian aid worker and member of the Tohono O'odham tribe, and we'll share a testimonial from an immigrant who recently crossed the desert into Arizona. Stay tuned. This is Kat Rodriguez, coordinator for Derechos Humanos in Tucson, Arizona. She begins by telling us more about the organization.
We mostly focus on educational efforts, advocacy, teaching people what their rights are. Teach people what are your rights when the Border Patrol stops you, what can you do when the police pull you over and they're asking about your immigration status. We do a lot of educational stuff specifically around the militarization of the border. We also track bodies, human remains recovered on the border, and try to show what the human cost has been of people who have attempted to cross and what our border policies have funneled people into. And, you know, it's a premeditated forcing of the migration patterns into the Arizona desert, really, more than anything. We also do, you know, educational stuff in the English-speaking community around militarization, around border security, around trade policies that have ultimately been the root of how this migration really began. Our organization, along with the Binational Migration Institute and some others, we are now shifting away from saying migrant deaths. We shift away from saying there are 5,000 people have died. The truth is, the ugly truth is that all we can really say is that more than 5,000 bodies have been recovered, and even bodies is not correct. I mean, it's more accurate to say human remains because, you know, this is a desert, and the desert eats everything, and it's completely unforgiving in the winter and in the summer. And unfortunately, within a month or so, you're not a body. Your parts, your pieces. There's been at least 20 people in the last 3 years where not even enough of their body was recovered to know if they're male or female. That's how awful it is. I mean, that's how horrific it is to be on the border, talking to family members, asking them for dental records, asking them for smiling pictures of their loved ones so that they can be compared to parts and pieces and bones of human remains that have been found. I mean, those are mothers and fathers and children and sisters and brothers. And it's a horrible, horrible way to die, but it's even more painful to not know what happened to your loved one.
Can you talk about who's coming and how far do they come?
Oh, they come from everywhere. They come from Colombia. They come from Honduras. We have people from mostly Mexican, but also Guatemala. El Salvador is another one that has a lot. It's various countries. It's usually poorer countries. It's the poorer states in Mexico, mostly agriculturally based communities where folks are being displaced. You do have more women and children crossing. A friend of ours likes to say that the border has been more successful at keeping people in than keeping people out, because years ago, before all of this happened, migration was a natural ebb and flow. You know, people would come up for a time and go back. My family's from Texas, and my mother talks about, you know, cotton picking season. The migrant workers would come up from Mexico, they would pick cotton, and they go back. People weren't necessarily staying here in the U.S. And some did. I mean, some established lives and stayed here, but many of them just would go up and back. Now, because it's so dangerous and so expensive and so difficult to cross, more and more people are now, once they're here, they stay here. So what we're also seeing is an increase in women and children for the purpose of reuniting. So children are now being sent for by their parents who left them 2, 3, 10 years ago. You have wives going to join their husbands, their partners, their kids. So in order to keep the family unit together, you know, family values, I mean, that's the real reason for migration. People want a better life for their families, and they're willing to risk their lives to get it.
And can you talk about what people are going through when they do make this trek across the desert? Like, what is the terrain like that people have to face?
Well, all of that has a million factors, and it's really a question of luck. It's a question of who your coyote or your guide is. It's a question of, you know, where you're coming from. It's also a question of how much money you have or are willing to spend across. Most people head up to Altar, which is about 4 hours from Tucson. I liken it to like the Chicago. It's the hub. People come from all over. They get to Altar, and then from there, if you don't have a coyote or a guide, you'll get one there. It's estimated that about 52% of people crossing into the country from Mexico are coming through Arizona. The majority of the people are crossing through what we call the Sasabe Corridor. And Sasabe is a little town. There's in Sasabe, Arizona, and Sasabe, Sonora. That's sort of the staging area. If they're crossing to the east of Sasabe, they're going to be going through the Buenos Aires National Wildlife Refuge. If they're going through the west, they're going to be going through the Tohono O'odham Nation, which is the tribe that's out here whose land is cut through by the border. It's rough, ragged terrain. There is not, some people I think have an idea that on the border there's all these little towns. There's nothing out there. I mean, 85% of Arizona's border is wildlife refuges and natural habitat and desert. I mean, it's wild. It's not like there's tons of towns. On the nation, there's scattered villages, but that's pretty far in. The average person crossing the border, once they get to the border, because what we're also finding is that the coyotes are having people walk further from the line. Many people are already in medical distress by the time they even get to the border. By the time they're even getting ready to cross, they've already been walking for a day or two. But typically from, say, Sasabe area to Tucson is over 70 miles, and it's rough, ragged terrain. There's cactus everywhere, very little water. It's extremely hot. It can get to be 110, 120 in the desert. And the other thing is a lot of the folks are coming from Chiapas, Oaxaca, Guatemala, where the climate is extremely different. The altitude's different. The humidity, they have humidity. We don't have humidity out here. It's very dry. So you'll get people, you know, you could tell them it's really hot in Arizona, but they're going to imagine the hottest they've ever been in Guatemala, and that'll come nowhere near to what they're going to experience out here. And there's been, you know, cases of young, healthy males, you know, in their mid-20s dying of heart attacks because their body could not handle crossing through the desert. Typically, they're walking 2, 3 days. If their guide has a pickup point, they're picked up and then taken into Tucson or Phoenix or other staging areas where they are then sent out to wherever they were going, Chicago or New Jersey or whatever town they were headed to. And that's kind of how it goes. And, you know, prices vary. I've not heard anybody for a long time that has told me they've crossed for anything less than $1,200. So I'd say between $1,200 and $3,500 is average, depending on where you're coming from and where you're going. And if you get to Central and South Americans, you're talking about doubling, tripling, quadrupling that sometimes.
We talked to a migrant about his recent experience crossing into Arizona.
Yo soy de San Antonio, Suchitepeque, Guatemala. La primera vez que hablamos en coyote en Guatemala.
I'm from San Antonio, Suchitepeque, Guatemala. The first time we talked to a coyote in Guatemala, he said that the journey would be 1,000 quetzales to wherever we needed to go. But this means having family members in the city where you're going to arrive, right? He took us on a train for about 6 days, and then we arrived in Mexico. Arriving in Mexico, they took our money. They didn't tell us where we were. Then they asked us if we wanted to stay or if we wanted to go back. So we said we wanted to stay. They said, tell us the truth about where you are from, and we said that we were from Guatemala. So with this, they asked us for money. They left one person with $30, another person $20, and another $10, and so on. They let us go. After the first time we arrived in Altar, the coyote told us that it was no more than one night that we would have to walk. But the problem that I had is that I began to get cramps in my feet, and this affected me on the journey. With just 2 hours to go to get us to the pickup spot, they told us we would have to stop, or something would happen to us. We stopped, and then we heard a dog behind us. I had my uncle with me at the time. We both ran. I forgot about the pain from the cramps, and I ran. My uncle ran also. It was about 3 in the morning, or maybe 1 in the morning, I don't remember very well. When we ran, it was dark, and we couldn't see the spines, and fell on the spines that are in the desert. I got up, and I ran again, and again I fell on the desert spines. I didn't run again. They got 2 Guatemalans and 3 Mexicans there. That was the first time. The second time, the new coyote told us that it would be 3 days and 3 nights walking. We arrived at the border. We walked. 2 robbers came out and asked for our money. Some people had $10. I had on me $5. Others had $30, which they took. They took the fruit that one friend from Guatemala was carrying. Afterwards, we kept walking. And in this, the coyotes, who were not from Guatemala, they are from other places, began to drink in the desert and fight amongst themselves. We began to despair because these coyotes, we didn't know them, and they brought us out in the desert. And so on Tuesday or Wednesday, we crossed the border and we walked. And only hills, rocks. There was a night when I saw lightning in the desert. And after the water calmed, the clouds came. We walked the whole night in the desert, and we couldn't see where we were going. We went down a slope, and there were only rocks, and we couldn't see anything. We kept walking. I was lost in the desert for the first time on the second journey. I called out the coyote by name. I screamed the name of the group. I yelled and yelled, but no one answered. I don't know how it was that they heard me, but they were on a hill and I was on a slope. At this time, I felt pain in my feet, and this was affecting me a lot on the walk. I had pulled out the spines from the first time, but the tips of the spines were still on my knees. The second walk was much longer, 7 or 8 days, something like that. We had little food, and the coyotes said we had to walk faster because we didn't have anything. We walked, and with the pain in my knees affecting me more, we walked. And we encountered big, long snakes, but they didn't do anything to us. Then we continued on. Later, they said, go up this hill, and then we'll rest. After about 1 in the afternoon, they told us we were going to keep walking, and we should leave our backpacks, and only take 1 gallon of water for every 2 people. We kept walking. The group told me, let's go. You can do it. We're going to make it. My knees were hurting more and more. I went on. We walked and walked and walked. Later, my group disappeared. The coyote wasn't there anymore. The coyote abandoned me alone in the desert. Alone, I had to walk in the desert, sleep in the desert. Again, I encountered large snakes, but God protected me from all these things that are in the desert. When the coyote left with the group, they left me without water, without anything. I had to walk. I had to drink very dirty water whenever I could find it, because in the desert, there was nowhere to find water. It's dry everywhere. I had to walk this way alone. I arrived at the house of some gringos and asked for water. They wouldn't give it to me. I kept walking, now on private land, where only animals live. It didn't matter to me. I kept walking, but I asked God to help me. I came to a highway where the immigration passes. I stayed there. I asked a gringo for water. He gave me a gallon and told his wife to call immigration. I was there for a short time, and immigration came to get me. I left Guatemala to give my family a better life. You can't make much there, and what you do earn is not enough. But seeing things in the desert, one repents and realizes that life is better in Guatemala because you are with your family, not risking your life as you are in the desert. They say that in the desert, life is bought. You can leave your home alive and die in the desert because there is nothing there. No water, no trees to rest under.
When you talked to the coyotes before you came, didn't they tell you about the reality of crossing the desert?
No, they hardly told us anything. They didn't tell us anything about how the desert is. The first coyote helped me. I wasn't going to make it. He said, let's go. I'll carry your backpack. He carried my backpack and he took my hand. The first coyote was good because he helped me. The second coyote was bad because he abandoned me in the desert with nothing, without water, without nothing. I alone needed to figure out how to get out of there. If I hadn't come out in the places that I did, I would have died there. I had a stick embedded in my knee and I could hardly stand up, but I walked with my leg full of infection. Thank God that I'm healthy and alive.
Con ese palo y así seguí caminando, pero ya con la pierna bien hinchada ya, de pura infección. Gracias a Dios, pues estoy con vida, estoy sano.
Now, we go back to our interview with Kat Rodriguez, the coordinator for Derechos Humanos in Tucson, Arizona.
Part of what you do, Kat, is to actually track bodies in the desert. Can you talk about what that entails?
So if we were to get a call today from somebody, and actually, you know, we've had the last 2 weeks, had about six cases that have come in, new ones. So somebody calls and says, my boyfriend was crossing the border. He was supposed to be here on Sunday morning. He sent me, you know, a message or called me or texted me, whatever, on Friday saying I'll be there Sunday, and we haven't heard from him since. The other thing we've gotten is people that have called and said, you know, I was in a group, I was crossing, and this person didn't make it, and they contact the family. A lot of times migrants will exchange information with each other in case something happens, so they'll call relatives for each other. So a lot of times a family member will call us and say, well, a guy in the group said that he got sick and he passed out and they couldn't revive him, and we left him there. I actually had to create a missing migrant form to ask all the questions that are pertinent. The name, their age, when they crossed, could they possibly have used another name? Sometimes people from Central South America buy fake Mexican ID, so, you know, would they have used a Mexican name? And then we ask physical description of what they were wearing, what they look like, did they have scars, birthmarks, if they have pictures of people, and we usually ask for smiling pictures because that shows more of the teeth and that makes it easier for the medical examiner to compare those teeth to remains that have come in. There's a lot of unidentified that come in. It takes a while to ID them. So if you have good teeth shots, I've even had a man from Peru or Colombia. His family was able to send me the dental records that their local dentist sent to them. So I was able to get that to the medical examiner. If enough information is known about where the person was, we contact BORSTAR, which is a Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Unit. And if there's enough information, they'll go look. And so we have about 4 or 5 cases right now that we're working with a couple agents on. And unfortunately, many times the person is like, he crossed in the desert. You know, you're like, well, where in the desert? Oh, I don't know. He's just there in the desert. And they don't realize how huge Arizona is. And we'll say, you know, did he cross through Nogales? Do you know if he crossed through Sasebar? Was he in Agua Prieta? Oh, I don't know. Just the desert. Those are some of the saddest ones because all you can tell them is, we'll let the medical examiner know. We check the detention centers. We have folks check the hospitals to see if anybody turned up. Other than that, there's nothing you can do but wait and hope that somebody matches or somebody turns up having been deported, which occasionally happens. And, yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, there's a woman last year, her 11-year-old boy went missing, and she'll call me and say, where's my little boy? It's been 7 months. Nothing's been found. No body of an adolescent that matches him has been found. And so she may never know. You know, she was from El Salvador, that woman. It's hard. It's very difficult and awful to be asking those questions, but that's where we are right now. We're down to bones, and we're down to, you know, looking for DNA to figure out who people are.
You have a relationship with the Border Patrol. How is that when, at the same time, these policies that you are working against are being enforced?
Well, not too much with the Border Patrol. I mean, we also, you know, we document abuses by law enforcement, but yet, you know, we still have to call the cops sometimes and track stuff and negotiate with them for marches and protests. I mean, we can't pretend that they're not part of society, right? And working with the medical examiner to get correct, accurate data, I stopped using Border Patrol data years ago. It's not in their best interest to show how many people are dying. So that's why on our website we have a recovered body count. You can see how many people are unknown, and you can see what the causes of death and where they were found and see how awful it is. But as far as, I mean, BORSTAR, it's hard to hate BORSTAR. I think it's ironic. BORSTAR was created because Border Patrol agents were getting hurt in the field, because they were being pushed also, because you're chasing people in these isolated, desolate areas, right? So they're being put in the same environment. So you had cases of Border Patrol agents who were getting hurt in the field. And so they created this unit called BORSTAR, who have, like, special forces-type training. They can rappel off cliffs. They can do swift water rescue. They can put an IV in the field. So I mean, these are advanced guys with medical training, and they self-select to go into Borstar. It's intense training. They don't get any more pay than anyone else. So a lot of the guys who go into that have gone into it because they're moved by the fact that they've seen people die in front of them, and they've found bodies, and some of them have, you know, want to be part of more, but they are also Border Patrol agents. So when they're not searching for someone or executing a rescue, they're out looking for folks. So it is a difficult, delicate balance, but all I can say is I've had Borstar agents being on the cell phone with me until 10, 11 o'clock at night while they're out on a search looking for someone who got sick and hopefully will turn up. It's really hard to hate that. What we have to recognize is that we're all human. And, you know, the other thing is a lot of them are Chicano, which is painful, too, for a lot of us Chicanos. They're like, man, why did it have to be a Chicano? But the economy is bad. This is a job that starts with $38,000 to start with benefits, and it's a government job, and people are selecting into it. And what I think needs to be acknowledged is for all the abuses we document, we can't say law enforcement are evil or racist or inherently bad people, because they're not. They're individuals. What we can say with absolute certainty is that there is a problem with accountability in these agencies, specifically with the Department of Homeland Security. And it makes it very difficult. The higher up on the totem pole that I've dealt with, the higher ups, they acknowledge to me. They're like, Kat, we know, you know, and hey, we want to know if there's an agent that's out of line. We want to know if there's an agent that's abusive. You know, Border Patrol agents have raped people. They've killed people. And they've stolen from people. They've also saved people's lives. You know, just like we can't say that every single migrant crossing the border is a good person. It's warm and fuzzy and cuddly. Like, no, there's also drug smugglers and there's rapists and there's criminals, just like, you know, in any other community you could find in the entire world. It's gray. But I think the fact that Borstar, we have a good working relationship as far as recovering bodies and doing searches, and it would be really hard for me to fault them for that work. I'd be a hypocrite to do it because we need them. And besides, they have a lot more money at their disposal than we do. They have these helicopters and they can do advanced searches. They have canine units. I mean, we need their resources, even though it's the policies that have caused the deaths.
I want to diverge just a little bit so that people can get an idea from you what the current political climate is right now in Arizona.
It's bad, pretty much. I mean, awful is another good word for it. Arizona, I think most people know Arizona as having the distinction of being the most anti-immigrant state in the country. We have anti-immigrant rhetoric and sentiment that is mind-boggling. If people don't think it's important, they should double think, because what happens in Arizona is not staying in Arizona, it's being exported. So if there's an anti-immigrant law that passes in Arizona, you can guarantee that replicas of it are going to be passed in other states, or at least attempted. So people should keep an eye on Arizona and see the new anti-immigrant laws and legislation and attempts that are happening. We're looking at demonizing and criminalizing an entire portion of our society. Immigrants, migrants are part of our society. They are in our schools, they're in our churches, in our families. Criminalizing and demonizing them is only a step to creating a system to demonize and criminalize anybody, and how you eliminate dissenters. And it's a systematic way of creating an other. And then the threat will be that your group will be the other. And I think that that's scary. That's scary in ways that people who don't care anything about immigrants should be frightened by. You don't have to care about immigrants or Mexico or border policy to recognize that this is a threat to the basis of our country, the civil liberties that we're based upon.
Again, this is Kat Rodriguez.
Unfortunately, Maricopa County is way bigger than Pima County, and that's why Arizona consistently goes as a red state, and that's why, you know, Joe Arpaio, is one of the worst sheriffs in the history of the world, is so popular, and that's why the Minutemen have come, and that's why the KKK considers Arizona a fertile recruiting ground, and that's why the National Alliance, a white supremacist group, has now opened an office in Tempe. That's a whole lot of scary, and it's all come to Arizona.
That is scary, but thanks for drawing the connection between the white supremacist groups and what has become mainstream politics.
Yeah. Well, I think people don't realize it, and they should be aware of the fact that in the last several years, the anti-immigrant movement and the white supremacist movement have begun joining forces, so that it's not just about, I don't like Mexicans, it's about white power. And it is about white power dominant mentality that is being used. So their strategy is now, you know, the KKK learned a lot from getting their pantsuit off, and they've done what they call the taking off the hood movement where they're not in your yard burning a cross, but they're strategically getting people into positions of power. They're strategically getting people into places where they can make decision and influence. They are learning, like, hey, you don't like immigrants, I don't like immigrants, and they pull people in on that common thread. Later they indoctrinate them into the white power philosophy. So, I mean, if you're not worried about it, you should be, because there are absolute connections between the white supremacist movement and the anti-immigrant movement, and it's blending more and more.
And we're facing those same things here in Oregon, so I appreciate you bringing that around for our listeners.
And I appreciate you letting me talk about the deaths and the recovered bodies, because I think that that should be the biggest point that should be made, is that people are dying. You know, people are dying a horrible, painful, awful way. The tragedy is it's affecting families here, families there, families who will never know. I mean, it's perpetuating pain and division. It's so completely senseless, and I don't have an understanding of it. I can't wrap my brain around the fact that if Americans were to see on the news that there's some country where over 200 people are dying on the border every year, and it's horrific, and they're dying in these horrible ways, Americans would just, you know, put their hand to their chest and say, that's just so barbaric. I'm so glad we're civilized in this country. And they don't know that just in Arizona, the bodies of, not even bodies, parts and pieces of more than 200 people are recovered every year, just in Arizona. We're not even talking about on the Mexico side. We're not even talking about California, New Mexico, or Texas. And nobody cares, and nobody knows, and nobody has any understanding of how devastating it is. People want to pretend this isn't about race and it's not about Mexico, but I'm sorry, but the KKK is down here. They're burning Mexican flags. 80% of militarization efforts are placed on the southern border, so don't tell us it's not about race, because it's about brown people, poor people, who've been displaced by our policies coming up in the way that we knew they would, the way that the creators of NAFTA knew would happen, and that's why they started building that wall. And it also ignores the fact that there's an indigenous element here, that many of our communities aren't from anywhere else. We're from here. We're from this side of the border, or we're from families right over the border. We are indigenous to this land. We are indigenous to these communities. To be treated like outsiders and to be treated like foreigners and invaders is the ultimate insult, I think, to people with indigenous blood, like most Chicanos, you know. I know people are very hesitant to talk about the race issue, and they'll tell us, don't play the race card. And we're like, the KKK is here. The National Alliance is here. Like, how is this playing the race card? The white supremacists are here. I really wish people could see that a little better and not be afraid to be honest about what it is. We're an organization, and we do a lot of coalitional work. Most people in our organization are parts of other groups as well, but we're an actual organization. Specific communities are our strongest allies. I'd say like Wingspan is the LGBTQ community, the community group here. And we have a very strong, very supportive relationship with Wingspan, because we recognize the ways that immigrants and migrants are being attacked right now is exactly the same way that queer people are being attacked. You know, they're the other, they're diseased, they're less than, they're non-deserving. All of the things, the less worthy arguments that are being made are made in the exact same way. And it's one of our strongest alliances, and one that I'm so proud that we've been unwavering on. Because it's difficult, especially in the Mexicano community. Homosexuality is not something that people are super comfortable with. And so we confront that, and we talk to people about, why is it not okay to make a homophobic comment? Why do we need to talk about that? And at the same time, you know, Wingspan gets comments like, why are we working with immigration issues? That's not our issue. And they talk to people about, you know, there are queer immigrants as well and migrants in our community, and that absolutely is part of it. And so it's important that we make those distinctions, and we're the ones that take those discussions on in our community and make sure that the discussion is being had. We do a lot of work with environmental groups. We formed a coalition a couple of years ago called the Coalition to Bring Down the Walls, which is an alliance between human rights, environmental, and indigenous rights groups. We also work with faith groups. We have alliances with unions. We pretty much work with anybody who can find common ground and see why the whole thing about an injustice to one is one to all. You know, I think that that's what should be based on, and we have a lot of strong allies out here. Coalition is definitely, I think, is the way to work. I think that's the way true change and systemic change is going to happen, is if we're not just saying I'm in solidarity with you, but actually giving up your struggle a little bit to learn about their struggle and learning. I don't talk about the border anymore ever without talking about the immigration impact on indigenous communities, on environmental communities, because that's our alliance and that's the way we do it, and our environmental allies do the same and our indigenous allies do the same, and that we need to change the language, and the only way to do it is to change the way we talk about things and acknowledging our neighbors. And I know people don't like to, and they have sort of a distaste for the immigration issue right now because they think, you know, I don't want to get involved with that. It's a little too messy. It's tricky. But what does that really say? And that's definitely not solidarity talking there. I would ask people to challenge themselves. It's not always comfortable, but it's the only way we're going to find common ground.
That was Kat Rodriguez, coordinating director at Derechos Humanos in Tucson, Arizona. You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley, and 91.9 in the Columbia Gorge. Tonight we are bringing you interviews about the humanitarian crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, where immigrants continue to suffer and die, crossing the desert in search of a better life.
This is an excerpt from the book The Devil's Highway by Luis Alberto Urrea. You'll pass through 6 known stages of heat death, or hyperthermia. The stages are heat stress, heat fatigue, heat syncope, heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. Heat stress. Everyone has been tired, or even dizzy, from walking in the heat. Everyone has been sunburned, sometimes quite badly, and many people have suffered the swollen fingers and the funny stumbling at the tail end of a hot hike. This is where it begins. General discomfort, nothing heinous. A little heat rash, headache from the glare, thirst. Heat fatigue. As you walk, the relentless heat makes your warm spots wet, your armpits, your crotch. Your head sweats, your neck, your skin blows a fine mist like steam to regulate your heat. You're a big swamp cooler, with water passing through your membranes and keeping the meltdown at bay. Your scalp burns along the part in your hair, or where your hair is thin. Your cheeks, your neck burn. Your eyelids burn too, and the tips of your ears. Your lips are not only burned by sun, but by wind. They become dehydrated, and they get rough and flaky, and you keep licking them to try to wet them, and they get sanded until they crack and bleed. Minor trouble. If you wore sandals, and many do, you are getting sunburns on the top of your feet. You might have blisters. Water goes through your system to fill them. Your drinking water is starting to get as hot as coffee. Your spit turns to paste. Your mouth tastes nasty, so you take another little drink. You tell yourself you'll only sip a couple more times, but to hell with it, you take a big pull off the bottle. Your lungs now are leaking moisture to the vampire air. Your tears leak into the sky, eyes dry and scratchy. The fluid in your lungs helps transport oxygen through the tissues into the blood. Less fluid, less oxygen. You breathe harder. You get drier. Heat syncope. You have a fever, though it's a fever imposed from the outside. Oddly, your skin is getting colder. Your face, even if you're a Mexican mestizo, turns pale. It gets a little hard to talk. When you go to lick your cracking lips, your tongue is dry and sticky. You speak in half consonants, chunks of thought. You talk like a stroke victim. Your mind is circling a couple ideas, and you try to use whatever discipline you have. I can take this next step. I can take this next step. This isn't so bad. Just one more sip. Don't gulp. One tiny little sip. Okay, just one. One more. One more. Suddenly your hot water is gone. You can't remember where you dropped the jug. Dizzy. Where's the water? Oh well, to hell with the water. I'll find water. You step behind a bush and urinate. Precious fluid and salt quite literally pissing away. Heat cramps. Now you're officially in trouble. Your body has been dumping salts. Without salts, your muscles can't function. Muscle cramps kick in. Your legs suddenly ache. You get clumsy. You tumble. When you fall, you hit rocks, cactus, gravel. Your arms hurt. Your calves hurt. Your hands hurt. Your heart can hurt. Your throat clicks when you try to swallow. Your abdomen clenches on you. You think you have to get to a toilet. If you're a woman, you're having contractions. You think you're going into labor. It's the men's first menstrual cramp. You double over. Heat exhaustion. Your fever is spiking now, and, as with the flu, you have gotten more and more ill. Headaches. You get nauseous. You want to vomit. If you vomit, you lose more fluids. Your body is weak and your will is slipping. Your breathing is shallow and fast, and each breath dries you further. Eyelids scrape across eyeballs, dry as pebbles. Your skin is icy. You might shiver. You get tunnel vision. You might hear echoes. Your body falls on burning ground. You stare through a little hole at the fading world. You can get second-degree burns from lying too long on the ground. And you sweat, especially where your body forms a seal with the earth. And you breathe. You get up worse than you fell, and then you fall again. You don't know much anymore. You are confused. Your memories are conflated with your dreams. The only clear thought in your mind now is, I'm thirsty. I'm thirsty. Sooner or later, you understand you have to drink your own urine. You piss in your hands, or whatever container you might have. You try not to dribble a single drop, and you lament all the priceless piss wasted on the desert floor. You hold your breath and forget the taboos, and you gulp your own hot mess. You've beat death with your own water. The first urine is pretty good, as urine goes. It's still relatively clear, since it's in the cycling through of your gallon of drinking water. The first urine is yellow, and if you're lucky, it's pale yellow. The next time through, that same urine has picked up more filtered impurities, and it's a little darker now. By the third round, it is orange, then dark orange, then pale brown, then a darker and more poisonous brown. It looks like foaming Guinness stout. By the time your effluent is black, you're doomed. Even if you wanted to, you probably couldn't drink it. Your body would retch. The last stage of hyperthermia begins. Heat stroke. Your blood is as low as it can get. Dehydration has reduced all your inner streams to sluggish mud holes. Your heart pumps harder and harder to get fluid and oxygen to your organs. Your sweat runs out. With no sweat, your body's swamp cooler breaks. The thermostat goes haywire. You're having a core meltdown. Your body panics and dilates all blood capillaries near the surface, hoping to flood your skin with blood to cool it off. You blush. Your eyes turn red. Blood vessels burst, and later, the tissue of the whites literally cooks until it goes pink, and then a well-done crimson. Your skin gets terribly sensitive. It hurts. It burns. Clothing feels like sandpaper. Once they're naked, they're surely hallucinating. Some dive into sand thinking it's water, and they swim in it until they pass out. They choke to death, their throats filled with rocks and dirt. Your muscles, lacking water, feed on themselves. Proteins are peeling off your dying muscles. Chunks of cooked meat are falling out of your organs to clog your other organs. The system closes down in a series. Your kidneys, your bladder, your heart. They jam shut, stop, your brain sparks, out. You're gone. Mike Wilson is a member of the Tohono O'odham tribe who lives in Tucson, Arizona. He begins by describing his humanitarian aid work at the border.
What I've been doing now for over 6 years is I put out down for stations for water. They're on the nation. And I have, as we speak, six of these stations. And what these stations consist of is two barrels for water. They're 55 gallons each. And I put them in a very strategic location that is in the Babakiri Trail, which is the deadliest migrant trail in the United States. I put them on tribal lands because migrants have been dying increasingly since about the year 2000. With the militarization of the borders, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line, the Border Patrol intentionally and systematically sealed historical migration routes from Mexico into the United States, specifically the El Paso, Texas area, the San Diego, California area. So what that did, that funneled migration from California and the El Paso, Texas area into what the Border Patrol euphemistically calls the Western Desert. So because the Sonora Desert area was left open. The consequences of Operation Hold the Line and Operation Gatekeeper was to force the migrants into the Western Desert, which includes Tohono O'odham tribal lands. And when I first started putting out water on the nation 6 years ago, I was a Presbyterian lay pastor living and working in the capital of the nation called Sells. And I noticed this cluster of migrant deaths immediately outside of Sells. And also, more significantly, I noticed that the nation was doing absolutely nothing to prevent for migrant deaths from happening on the tribal lands. They transit across the length of the nation land from south to north, and they're trying to get to Phoenix initially and moving from Phoenix on throughout the country.
I think some people who aren't familiar with Arizona might not realize how much land is actually part of the Tohono O'odham Nation. Can you describe that a little bit for our listening audience?
The reservation land is vast. As a matter of fact, it's comparable in land size to the state of Connecticut. Our traditional lands also go into the Mexican state, to Sonora. So we have tribal members like other tribes along the U.S. Border with Mexico and also the Canadian border. But the land out here is described as the Sonora Desert. It is a very unforgiving desert. And the most lethal part about living in the desert or trying to travel in the desert during the summer is the heat. Temperatures reach 115 degrees. And that's what's killing migrants as they try to come across tribal lands or any lands in southern Arizona. There's mountainous areas, but the migrants pretty much stay in the valleys. Until recently, there's evidence trying to cross over the mountains, which makes it even more dangerous. What their coyote tells them is that carry only enough water for 4 or 5 hours walk. So this coyote deceives these migrants who are very trusting of him. These migrants are ill-prepared, and they may carry 1 or 2 gallons each. That 1 or 2 gallons may last them for half a day. And if they're out there, you know, more than 24 hours, then they begin to suffer the devastating illnesses and the onset of dehydration. So one story in particular, he had been walking through the reservation again in the Babakiri Valley, and he had gotten separated the night before by the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol scattered the group, and they ran in the night. The next morning, he walks to a road, and that's when I drive up on him. He has been walking for 3 days, him and his group, rather, before they got scattered. He had only walked 17 miles in 3 days. He had no water. He had no food. He had no coyote. And he had no companionship. He was alone in the desert. And he asked me, "How far is it to Phoenix?" I told him, "You will never get to Phoenix. I cannot give you enough water. I can give you water, but you can't carry enough water to survive another day or two at most." And what was tragic is he had a wife who needed surgery, and he had, I believe he said, 3 children. So they were depending upon him to come north, find work, and send money home so that the wife could get her surgery and he could put food on the table for his 3 children. So the only thing that I could do at that time, you know, because I cannot transport them, because those of us humanitarian workers were subject to prosecution if we transport other than for medical different situations. And so what I told him, you have to get out of the desert. And I recommended that he turn himself into the Border Patrol. And he would be sent back to Mexico in 2 or 3 days. That much smarter and that much wiser, and possibly to try again. And he said to me, I would rather try to walk north, and if I die, I would rather die trying to feed my children, because which is worse? For me to walk north and I will probably die, or to me to go back to my home in Mexico and watch my 3 children starve to death? That's my choice. Ultimately, I was able to convince him, you know, death is imminent. Please turn yourself into the Border Patrol. The worst that's going to happen is they're going to apprehend you, detain you and process you, and return you to Nogales, Sonora in a couple of days. It's your choice to go back home or to try again. But my moral obligation right now is to convince you to get out of the desert. So that's what he did, as far as I know. That sort of demonstrates the economic situation, the economic desperation that drives migrants north, looking for work, looking to put food on the table for themselves, for their wife, and for their children. And I think all of us would do the same thing.
I understand that some people, when they're in the desert, will also get various injuries, including kidney damage, and are sent back to their countries, in effect, to die because of lack of medical care. Can you talk a little bit about the other dangers if you survive the trek through the desert?
The case in point that comes to mind, again, a couple of years ago, I came across a mother and 7-year-old girl who had been abandoned the night before. The coyote told the mom and her daughter, go out to the highway and I will send a vehicle to pick you up tomorrow morning. They were standing on the side of the road when I drove by. The mother was in tears because during the night, the 7-year-old girl had begun to pass blood when she had to use the restroom. That was a clear sign of the onset of kidney damage. And this was a 7-year-old girl. And so I convinced her to let me drive them to the hospital in Sells and go to ER because the mother and the daughter both needed emergency medical care. Possibly the kidney damage was arrested. I don't know. But even if they survive, many of them suffer permanent kidney damage. And if they're returned to Mexico, more than likely their host country does not have the medical facilities, does not have the medical infrastructure to maintain them on dialysis 3 to 4 times per week. They very well likely will die soon because of the damage that they suffered in the desert.
I really appreciate the work you're doing. It's very hard for me to imagine how you do it day in and day out sometimes when you are faced with people who are really, you know, in that life or death situation or their families who are looking for them. So what kind of support do you ask for people when you're going out and sharing the stories about the reality there in the desert?
Well, specifically down for me, as a member of my nation, the Autumn Nation, I hold my own tribal government morally accountable for migrant deaths. And to add insult to injury, many of these migrants that are dying are indigenous people, which makes it even worse. One death is horrendous. Last year, 83 migrants died on Tono Autumn tribal lands. 83 that we know of. And I know of 7 whose bodies were never recovered because I was involved in trying to find 4 of the 7. And how many beyond that, we'll never know. So I hold my Tono Autumn tribal government, but specifically the Legislative Council, morally responsible for migrant deaths. When you know that year after year after year, 75, 80, 85, migrants will die, it's no longer a theoretical supposition. This happens year after year. It is a form of a crime against humanity, because it's on the nation. We as indigenous people, we should have learned the history of exploitation. We have forgotten that history. And the Tono'o Nation has done nothing. As a matter of fact, has refused. Humane Borders asked permission of the Tribal Council and several of the district councils several years ago for permission to provide humanitarian aid on tribal lands. And they were told no year after year after year. So my battle as a Tono'o is, how do I convince the Tono'o and tribal government to accept its moral responsibility and prevent human deaths?
Again, this is Mike Wilson.
The Tono'o and tribal government already has a water management program, but the water management program is designed to water cows and horses so that cows and horses do not dehydrate during the droughts. So the infrastructure is there for the Tono'o Nation if it had the moral will to address migrant deaths. But the Tono'o Nation does not address migrant deaths. It evades that moral question. Their response to migrant deaths is, they talk about criminality. By the nature of the migrants coming across, they are illegals. So they try to maintain the conversation on legalistic grounds. And on legalistic grounds, you know, they're on solid ground. We as human beings, we as indigenous people, we have a moral responsibility as individuals and as a government to provide humanitarian aid so that no one, no human being, deserves to die in the Sonora Desert on Tono'o tribal lands for lack of a cup of water. The nation has continuously refused to permit humanitarian aid groups. They don't even like the fact that I, as a tribal member, and David Garcia, who's been helping me now going on 3 years, that we as tribal members are putting out water on tribal lands. And even my water stations are destroyed or confiscated by entities of the tribal government. I don't know if it's the police department or the land management part or who. But year after year, my water barrels, just 3 weeks ago, some of my water barrels were punctured. This is in the middle of the desert, and it was probably 110 degrees. And the nation does absolutely nothing to prevent migrant deaths from dying. I have to convince people in this area, including the social justice community, you must hold the Tono'o Nation morally accountable. And I think that white America doesn't want to go there. I think that white America will not criticize indigenous peoples. In this case, Tono'o Nation. The reason I say that is because every summer, as the migrants' death increase by month, you hear this moral outrage by the social justice community against United States border policies, which contributes directly to migrant deaths, specifically a moral outcry against the Border Patrol as an instrument of the United States government's border policies. But when it comes to migrants dying on Tono'o land, there is no moral outrage. And I asked my brothers and sisters in the social justice community, where is your moral outrage voice now? Why don't you hold me and my people accountable and my government accountable do not think that you honor me as a Native American by your silence. Your silence dishonors me. What this seems like to me is that there is a double moral standard, that we hold the Border Patrol to a higher moral standard, and we measure migrant deaths against this moral standard. But when it comes to migrants dying on tribal lands, there is no moral standard. And if there is no moral standard, there is no moral outcry. And so this lack of accountability, this reluctance, this hesitation, this fear, or this guilt by white America to hold Native Americans accountable is unpardonable. However, Humane Borders is on record as holding the Tohono O'odham Nation accountable for migrant deaths. But the rest of the groups, there's absolute silence. They don't want to criticize the nation. There cannot be any moral exemptions when it comes to human beings dying in the desert. So if I can do anything, is to say to white America, it's okay to criticize Native Americans. It's okay to criticize and hold morally accountable the Tohono O'odham tribal government. We are human beings. We are equals in this republic. So you must hold us accountable. But white America does not want to go there. And so how do I convince, you know, the greater population? You must hold all of us accountable. Contact the tribal government and tell the Tohono O'odham Nation they must accept a moral responsibility. They cannot be let off the hook. We're all in this together. And there cannot be this silence, this lack of accountability. People are dying.
Thanks to Kat Rodriguez of Derechos Humanos in Tucson and Mike Wilson of the Tohono O'odham Nation. We thank those migrants who are brave enough to share their difficult experiences crossing the desert. Thanks also to Mark DeGier and Luis Alberto Uria. For more information, go to www.derechoshumanosaz.net. You can also check out humaneborders.org and nomoredeaths.org. And the book, Dying to Live, A Story of U.S. Immigration in an Age of Global Apartheid by Joseph Nevins. We have links for these resources and more, and the audio from this show on our website at kbu.fm/CircleA Radio. Circle A Radio is broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 till 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7. Our next show will be preempted to bring you Pacifica's coverage of the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. We'll be back on September 17th. Thanks for listening.